Welcome back to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. A reminder, tomorrow we're having a forum, a debate here with candidates for the Bexar County Sheriff. You get to ask the tough questions. We'll take your calls and emails. It's your chance to raise the issues that matter to you. That's going to be tomorrow right here on The Source. But for right now, we're going to talk about civil liberties, or what we as a nation think they might be and how far they extend. And of course, like right now, we're in presidential debate season. And back in 1988, when Vice President George Herbert Walker Bush was running against Governor Mike Dukakis, Bush repeatedly accused him of something, being a supporter of ACLU, not just a supporter, but being a card-carrying member of the ACLU. And at a presidential debate, here's how Peter Jennings put the question.
I'd actually like to follow up, if I may, on this mention you've made of his card-carrying membership in the American Civil Liberties Union. Now, you've used the phrase card-carrying so many times since Governor Dukakis first acknowledged that he was a card-carrying member of the ACLU that some people have come to believe that you've used it to brand him in some way, to identify him as people were identified in the 1950s as less than patriotic. I'd like to know why you keep repeating the phrase, what's the important issue here? What is so wrong with the governor being a member of an organization which has come to the defense of, among other people, Colonel Oliver North?
Nothing's wrong with it. But just take a look at the positions of the ACLU.
Bush went on to say that he didn't agree with the ACLU because they wanted to take the X rating off of movies and remove In God We Trust off of money, and they support those who didn't want to say the Pledge of Allegiance. And then Bush went on to easily win the White House. Today, the ACLU is in the middle of almost virtually every controversy that we enjoy today, from the government and Yahoo scraping emails, public access to videos of police shootings, voter ID, the rights of the homeless, athletes who choose not to stand for the national anthem. So what is the American Civil Liberties Union? What are they? What are these civil liberties that they talk about? And as we know them today, compared to how they were understood in America and in the courts before the First World War, we're joined by Laura Weinrib, professor of law and a scholar at the University of Chicago Law School. Her new book is The Taming of Free Speech, America's Civil Liberties Compromise. And Laura, hi, welcome to The Source.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So, the taming of free speech. Free speech has to be tamed?
Well, I would say free speech was tamed, in fact. So, you know, that's a great clip. We have a sort of familiar understanding of what the ACLU stands for. There's been a lot of controversy over what the ACLU's agenda has been and ought to be. What my book does is it suggests that the way civil liberties originated in the first part of the 20th century, largely through the efforts of the ACLU, was very different from what we've understood, and the rights that the ACLU was advocating during that period were very different from the sorts of rights that you've just described. So today we think of civil liberties, we think of the ACLU as defending the right of speakers to express their ideas, however unpopular or subversive they may be. Certainly from a contemporary perspective, it seems as though that's not particularly tame. But in fact, what they were advocating during the first part of the 20th century was something much more radical. It was the right of workers to engage in activity that we today think of as primarily economic rather than expressive, the right of workers to picket, boycott, and strike, not merely to advocate unpopular ideas.
And the right to agitate. So one of the great characters in your book is Roger Nass Baldwin. What a great guy. You know,
yeah,
what an incredible story. Character. And so Massachusetts aristocrat, you know, becomes an advocate, a fighter. But he didn't really have a firm vision of what these civil rights were at the time. It was still pretty much proto-civil rights. They were trying to come up with something that they could use to keep conscientious objectors from having to go into World War One. He himself spent a year in prison as a conscientious objector. And from there, there was a struggle over what tools they could use to try to establish the civil rights. And why were they so reluctant to go to the courts for this?
That's right. Okay, so there's a lot in your question. Roger Baldwin is absolutely a fascinating character. He, in fact, joined the Industrial Workers of the World, which was a radically anti-statist labor organization. He was reluctant to go to the courts because the courts were associated with two things during the Progressive Era, with striking down economic legislation, progressive reform initiatives that were designed to be redistributive or to help workers, things like minimum wage laws and maximum hours laws. And also the courts were associated with issuing what were known as labor injunctions, preventing workers from engaging in strikes that were effective in advancing their goals. For those reasons, it wasn't just the labor radicals within the ACLU that opposed the courts. It was actually mainstream progressives, the band of the political spectrum we would now describe as liberals. The ACLU tried an approach with Baldwin at the helm for the first few years of the 1920s that worked outside of the courts. They tried direct action, grassroots activism, but they found that they weren't particularly successful using those methods. And so they turned to the courts as a strategy. They were willing, essentially, to try whatever it took to advance their substantive agenda of workers' rights. But they did it through ways that were not obviously about labor. So even though they had described the organization when it was formed as serving, frankly, as a partisan of labor, they quickly moved into areas that were more politically palatable and, in fact, reached alliances not so much with mainstream liberals who remained reluctant to embrace the courts during this period, but rather with conservatives who had their own independent reasons for embracing the courts.
But it's so interesting today as we think about our civil rights or civil liberties and the right to free speech and the freedom of the press and the right to own a gun and all these people see that as a part of the original vision of the founders of the and the writers of the Constitution. Not so much. This has been a process.
That's right. And in fact, for the first 100-some years of American history, there was nothing like a strong First Amendment or a strong Bill of Rights. I should say the First Amendment begins with the words, Congress shall make no law. It was an amendment that applied to the federal government. The states were free to regulate expression and activity more or less as they saw fit. And even with respect to the federal government, the courts were really reluctant to intervene with legislation or other activity that the state was carrying on. The courts essentially left the government to regulate and legislate as it saw fit. The conventional view of how that changed is about World War One, which you've already mentioned, which is that the suppression of dissent during World War One was so egregious that a few sort of right-seeing American theorists and judges awoke to the value of a strong First Amendment. But in fact, it's a much more complicated story, and as I've already suggested,
and we're going to get into that. We'll get into that. We're going to have to take a one-minute break. We're going to continue our conversation about the taming of free speech, America's civil liberties compromise. We're speaking with Laura Weinrib, and you're invited into the conversation, 210-614-8980. What do you think about your civil liberties? This is The Source on KSTX. You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. You have the right to protest. You can voice your opposition to the war. You can be in favor of teaching evolution. You can read a copy of Ulysses. You can thank Roger Baldwin and the ACLU for that. How the American Civil Liberties Union came to be and how it changed the nation's basic understanding of our rights, our civil liberties. It's covered in the book, The Taming of Free Speech, America's Civil Liberties Compromise. The author is law professor Laura Weinrib. And Laura, let me ask you about some of these judges. You mentioned them briefly when we went to break, especially Justice Brandeis, Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes. They were dissenting. They lost a lot of these cases, but still they were able to steer the court.
Well, I'll agree with you on the first point. They were dissenting. As I was starting to say, the conventional understanding is that it was those dissents that persuaded eventually a majority of the Supreme Court to come along with a new, more robust understanding of the First Amendment as protecting the right to engage in the political process and as essentially flushing out truth, that the best test of truth was its ability to prevail in the marketplace of ideas. The trouble is that actually for much of the 1920s, first of all, there was no Supreme Court majority holding agreeing with those dissenting justices. And secondly, many mainstream liberals opposed the idea that the First Amendment should be in the business of striking down legislation or of invalidating prosecution.
Right, so they were not using a violation of my right to free speech as a defense to overthrow a law that was suppressive.
That's exactly right. So they believed that free speech was an important public value. That was true for much of American history, if not all of it. There has long been a sense that it's important to preserve a public sphere with rich debate to arrive at the best public policy. But they didn't think that the courts were the best way to achieve that. They wanted to elect sensible legislators who wouldn't pass restrictive laws. They wanted to appoint prosecutors and judges who wouldn't reach convictions. What they disagreed with the ACLU about was this idea of turning to the courts and asking them to intervene and to essentially curb the power of the state.
But they were originally looking to the legislature to carve out exceptions for the right to not go to war, to be a conscientious objector, and also to be able to strike.
That's right. To some extent, I should say the debate over labor rights was a very sort of complicated and protracted one. But there was a consensus among many progressives during the Progressive Era that free speech was a good thing. World War I did really challenge that because many people believed that once Congress had reached a decision to go to war, the time for debate was over and that people had to cease dissenting. And that's what provoked this crisis among this slice of legal theory and justices that I mentioned.
After all, it was a war to spread democracy throughout the world, but the people who were opposed to it saw it as a war that was to defend the bankers and their investments in Europe.
That's right. There was a lot of belief among socialists, among some more mainstream labor activists, although I should say not the AFL, that the war was serving the interests of capital and should therefore be opposed. And so many of the prosecutions of dissenters during World War I that we think of as suppressing anti-patriotic speech, were in fact suppressing labor speech. And that's how the ACLU understood them. I should say the precursor to the ACLU because the modern ACLU had not yet organized. But that's how Roger Baldwin and his fellow free speech advocates understood them.
Right, but there's all these fights within this progressive movement trying to find effective arguments that will be able to reach their goals, achieve the desired outcome. And it seemed like they were just grasping at straws, trying to find something that would work, a key that would open up the lock. And finally, they came upon, hey, this works, arguing for the freedom of speech and all these civil liberties. But before that, they were going about liberty of conscience and things that are very similar to the Religious Freedom Restoration Act stuff that we talk about today.
That's right. And I should say all of those claims were absolutely unsuccessful, but so were free speech claims during this period for the most part. As I said, they made some headway in convincing people free speech was a good value, but not in getting it defended in court. So the story really has to carry into the 1920s and 1930s. And what happened during that period is that when the ACLU failed to accomplish its agenda through non-judicial means, and I should say all the way up until 1924, the ACLU was calling flatly for disbanding, for basically stripping the power of the courts to review legislation. This is a group today we identify perhaps most closely with constitutional liberalism, with the idea that the courts should be reviewing legislation and striking it down if it's unconstitutional. They were basically calling for that power to be removed. But when they failed to accomplish their objectives through other means, what they did is they began sort of experimenting with a litigation strategy. And the litigation strategy they tried operated through channels that were not as obviously about labor. Issues like sex education and academic freedom and to some extent birth control, where they thought they could get buy-in from a broader coalition, and they were successful in that. They started to make some incremental victories on these other issues in ways that started to increase support for the modern concept of civil liberties.
We're speaking with law professor Laura Weinrib. She is the author of The Taming of Free Speech, America's Civil Liberties Compromise. So what are the compromise? Who's bending here?
Okay, so the compromise really takes place in the 1930s. And this is where these labor radicals within the ACLU make common cause with conservatives in a very significant way. We often think of the modern understanding of free speech as a victory for the left and for liberals, in much the way that your opening clip suggested, that this idea that the First Amendment will protect the right to advocate radical ideas always served the left until very recently. And I should say current debates about things like Citizens United, campaign finance, hate speech have really brought these issues to the fore again. But what I discovered in researching this book is that in the 1930s, the cards just didn't line up that way. So you have the radical left pushing for a robust concept of free speech because they want to protect the strike and boycotts and picketing. New Deal liberals wanted to prop up state power. They wanted the state to continue to be able to pass legislation. And conservatives were worried that basically two things happened. One was that the New Deal legislation started to seriously threaten commercial interests and corporate interests. And simultaneously, as the court struck down important New Deal legislation, Americans, for the first time in many decades, stood a reasonable chance of limiting judicial review, of getting the court out of the business of reviewing legislation. There were amendments floated at the time, constitutional amendments, court curbing legislation that might have crippled the courts. And so conservatives understood
that. And this is the nightmare that Supreme Court justices have all the time about being too aggressive with their with their rulings, and they never want to see this return, but it could.
That's absolutely right. And in fact, we are seeing parallel language today in calls for constitutional amendments over campaign finance. So what essentially happened is that conservatives embraced these free speech arguments for on behalf of radicals that they had opposed during the 1920s. Held them up as an example of why judicial review was good for the little guy. They said the court will defend the rights of radicals, and therefore you should leave judicial review alone. As it happened, the court itself in the spring of 1937 got out of the business of striking down New Deal legislation. It essentially began deferring to Congress on economic issues. But at that point, conservatives quickly understood what I would call the road to Citizens United. They quickly understood that the First Amendment could serve as an independent check on state authority, a way of protecting the right to lobby, to engage in commercial advertising, and to undo burdensome regulatory measures.
So it was a compromise between liberals who wanted to protect the right to strike and conservatives who wanted to make sure that free speech was available to them as they pushed their own agendas.
That's right.
Now, I want to get back to Roger Baldwin And so he, of course, the founder of the ACLU and was the head of it until the 1950. And he basically almost like him single-handedly, I don't want to exaggerate or use hyperbole, but it seemed like he really willed into being our modern concept of what our civil liberties are.
In a real way, that's right. Roger Baldwin was, in some sense, a visionary as well as a pragmatic master of sort of organizational politics. He was extremely good at understanding when to compromise, at basically making the sorts of long-term decisions he needed to make to advance his goals. That said, I want to emphasize that by 1940, this early labor radical vision of civil liberties that the ACLU had advanced had really changed. By bringing in all of these supporters of a more moderate civil liberties agenda, the ACLU chain itself changed, the organizational leadership changed, the membership changed, so that by 1940s, in fact, the ACLU was committed to a very neutral understanding of free expression and, in fact, did disclaim any underlying substantive agenda.
Right, and pursuing what Roger Baldwin called the whole truth. Laura Weinrib, great talking with you. Fantastic book, The Taming of Free Speech, America's Civil Liberties Compromise. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
This is The Source on Texas Public Radio.